Was bedeutet Erinnerung? Was bedeutet es, den Unbekannten eine Geschichte zu geben? Was bedeutet es, Geschichte mit Menschlichkeit zu erzählen? Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum Podcast Unsere geteilte Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth unvergessen. Dem Podcast vom Volksbund Deutscher Kriegsgräberfürsorge e.V., Landesverband Berlin. Ich bin Holly Perchel, Praktikantin beim Volksbund und Studentin an der Universität Leeds in Großbritannien. Ich leite das Forschungsprojekt Unsere geteilte Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth unvergessen. Das Ziel des Projekts ist es, biografische Informationen über die Gefallenen aus dem Commonwealth herauszufinden, sodass die Gefallenen, egal ob Soldat oder Zivilist, als Menschen anstatt als reine Statistik erinnert werden. In jeder Folge des Podcasts werde ich die Geschichte von Gefallenen erzählen, die in der ehemaligen britischen Besatzungszone Berlins gegraben wurden. Es ist meine Absicht, dass ihre Geschichten mit Menschlichkeit, Respekt und Mitgefühl dargestellt werden. Für jede erzählte Geschichte werde ich den Friedhof der Gefallenen, den Berlin War Cemetery in der Heerstraße, besuchen und ihnen eine weiße Rose niederlegen. Diese weißen Rosen symbolisieren nicht nur Erinnerung und Dankbarkeit, sondern auch Menschlichkeit. Die meisten der Biografien sind sicherlich Fliege gewesen. Die Bombardierung von Städten wurde von den Kriegsparteien beider Seiten als Kampfmittel gegen die Zivilbevölkerung eingesetzt. Obwohl ich mich in diesem Podcast vor allem mit Berlin beschäftige, waren natürlich nicht nur deutsche Städte von Bombardierungen betroffen. Im Jahr 1939 findet die ersten Angriffe statt. Die deutsche Luftwaffe flog auf die Städte Warschau und Rotterdam. Ab Mai 1940 flog die britische Luftwaffe die ersten Angriffe auf deutsche Städte. Am 14. November 1940 flog die deutsche Luftwaffe unter dem Decknamen Unternehmen Mondscheinsonate einen schweren Bombenangriff auf Coventry, Mitte Englands. Am 3. Februar 1945 findet eine der heftigsten Bombardierungen Berlins statt. Von 1958 Maschinen der United States Army Air Forces kamen 939 durch die deutschen Verteidigungslinien. Wir sprechen hier von schweren Bomben mit 10 bis 12 Mann Besatzung. Wenn man mal hochrechnet, wie viele Menschen in der Luft waren, 9.580 bis ungefähr 11.500. Die albtraumatischen Bilder aus dem Krieg in der Ukraine lassen uns einen das Schicksal dieser Menschen noch mehr erahnen. Und es wirkt auf einmal alles viel realer, obwohl es schon fast 80 Jahre her ist. Mit 78 Jahren ist der Zweite Weltkrieg bald fast 3 Generationen vorbei. 78 Jahre, eigentlich die Zeitspanne eines Lebens. Was hätten diese Menschen von einem Leben zu erzählen gehabt? Und hier kommen wir wieder zu dem Thema, können wir gemeinsam erinnern? Oder wie ist es möglich, gemeinsam zu erinnern, in Freundschaft? Welche Rolle spielt das Politische und das Persönliche in der Erinnerungskultur? Ist kollektive Erinnerung möglich, wenn unsere nationalen Narrativen so unterschiedlich sind? Mein ganzes Leben lang habe ich mich für deutsche-britische Beziehungen im Lauf der Geschichte interessiert. Seit meiner Schulzeit hat mich das Vorurteil über die deutsche Sprache in Großbritannien sogar in unserem Bildungssystem fasziniert. Wieso ist es, dass Deutsch immer noch als aggressiv in britischen Medien dargestellt wird? Ich werde sehr häufig gefragt, wieso ich Deutsch gelernt habe. Solche Fragen bekommen Französisch- und Spanisch-StudentInnen nicht. Ich finde es schade, dass in Großbritannien dieses Vorurteil immer noch so sichtbar in unserer Gesellschaft ist. Besonders wenn Großbritannien viel von Deutschland im Bereich der Erinnerungskultur lernen könnte. Wir haben selbst Schuld und trotz der Entwicklung vom Postkolonialismus und solchen Bewegungen wie Why is my curriculum white und Black Lives Matter ist die Rolle des Kolonialismus in unserer Geschichte ein sehr umstrittenes Thema. Wir haben selbst noch viel zu tun, um unsere Vergangenheit zu bewältigen. Man bekommt den Eindruck, dass Verurteile gegen andere Länder oft als praktische Ausrede genommen wird, um uns mit unserer eigenen Geschichte in Großbritannien, mit unserer eigenen Schuld nicht zu konfrontieren. Seit dem Brexit mache ich mir viele Sorgen über mein eigenes Land. Wir haben so lange in Großbritannien eine kulturelle Amnesie, in der die Geschichte immer noch sehr selektiv erzählt wird. Meiner Meinung nach war der Brexit eine Bestätigung dieser Amnesie, einen Angriff gegen eine transkulturelle Erinnerungskultur. Mit diesem Projekt möchte ich die Erinnerungskulturen von Großbritannien und Deutschland zusammenbringen. Laut meiner Auffassung ist Frieden eine Frage der Zusammenarbeit. Kollektiv zu erkennen bedeutet, Grenzen zu bewältigen, Menschen zusammenzubringen, um gegen Hass und Verurteil zu kämpfen. Dabei hilft, miteinander zu reden, aufeinander zuzugehen, sich kennenzulernen, abseits der Politik und Nachrichten und die jeweiligen Geschichten zu kennen. Daher möchte ich Sie auch mitnehmen, um die vielleicht Ihnen unbekannten Geschichte zu erzählen. In jeder Folge des Podcasts hören Sie zwei Geschichten der Gefallenen aus dem Commonwealth und Interviews mit ExpertInnen im Bereich der Erinnerungskultur. In dieser Folge beschäftigen wir uns mit dem Thema Wahrheit. Gibt es eine Wahrheit über die Geschichte oder sogar mehrere Wahrheiten? Was bedeutet es, die wahre Geschichte zu erzählen? Inwiefern ist Geschichte subjektiv? Und vor allem, wo liegt die Grenze zwischen Subjektivität und falsche Information? In der folgenden Geschichte ist die Rolle der Wahrheit besonders wichtig. Heute möchte ich die Geschichte von der Royal Air Force Staffel 100 und Sergeant Jack Rowland Wales erzählen. Diese Geschichte ist besonders interessant, weil der Familie von Wales viele falsche Informationen über sein Schicksal erzählt wurden. Um die Gründe für diese Fehlinformation genauer zu untersuchen und die wahre Geschichte vom Sergeant John Rowland Wales und seiner Fliegstaffel zu klären, haben wir ein Interview mit Steve Smith. Steve Smith ist Forscher und leitet Schlachtfeldführungen. Er hat 3 Bücher über die Geschichten von verschiedenen Fliegerstaffeln aus dem Ersten und Zweiten Weltkrieg geschrieben. Great War Britain, Norfolk Remembering 1914-1918, The Norfolk Regiment on the Western Front 1914-1918 und And They Loved Not Their Lives Unto Death. Das folgende Interview wird auf Englisch durchgeführt. Der Text des Interviews auf Deutsch und Englisch stehen im Anhang zur Verfügung. Would you like to briefly introduce yourself?
So my name's Steve Smith and I am a battlefield guide and author.
Thank you so much for your time. So the first question that I'd like to ask you is regarding your first book. You wrote about Sergeant Jack Rowland Wales of the Royal Air Force 100 Squadron, and you've since revisited this particular story. So I was just wondering, why is the story of Sergeant Jack Rowland Wales unique, and why did you decide to pursue it further?
So he's unique in the sense that when I researched my first book, which is about the war memorial of my village, which is a village called Worstead, and the village next door to it, which is called Westwick, in the church there's the war memorial, and on there, Jack is the only man to have been killed serving in the Royal Air Force. Everyone else was Army, so that's where he's unique. And then secondly, so I'd written about him, and I know you're going to ask more questions about this, but so I knew the story, but it was really weird that my daughter lives in Grimsby, and of course if you've read the blog, you know that's where they were based, you know, what was known as RAF Grimsby. And I started driving by the airfield. On the A16, you literally drive past the remains of the airfield. And for some reason, I'd never really tallied the two up together. And I thought, do you know what? I need to stop one day and actually take the photographs of the place that he took off from. So that's why I revisited, because I just wanted to add on to it, really. And also put in that bit more of extra information that we'll talk about.
Yeah, I think it's really admirable that you've gone back to this story, and I think that it's also speaks to the nature of archival work in general, that a story never really ends, does it? There's always new lead. And I think that's something that's so special, that although the fallen have so tragically lost their lives, that their story lives on in so many different ways, which I think is really fascinating. So in your book, you mentioned the fascinating inconsistencies and sort of mistruths in this story, such as Warrant Officer Fred Hugh David being listed as Canadian when he actually came from Texas. So how did these mistruths develop, and why are they so interesting to you as well?
So if you look at the crew, Fred Hugh Davis is listed as Canadian Air Force. And I suppose when you look at it, you take that as that being correct. But a few years ago, a gentleman called Vernon Williams, who's an American, contacted me about this. And he said that he'd read my book and found out this new information, because he was making a film about Warrant Officer Davis. And he had found out that what had happened is that he'd gone from the U.S., through into Canada and had joined the Canadian Air Force before technically the US were at war, and so for some reason it's never been properly listed that he's US forces, or not US forces, but from the US. But we can definitely state that that's where he comes from, because Vernon did a lot of work and he made a film. And what was lovely in the end was that he came to the UK, he came to Norwich, and in a place called the Forum, he actually had the film put on the screen. I was invited along with another relative from the crew, with a group of other people, and we got to watch the evidence that Vernon put forward. And there's no doubt that Warrant Officer Davis is an American. So it was just lovely to tie that up. I mean, I do think about writing to the War Graves Commission about it, just to see if we can get that clarified, because there is so much evidence now that we could probably present that.
Yeah, and I think it's so special that you talk about almost developing this archival family, don't you? Where, like, through developing a story, you meet so many different people, and it's so wonderful to be able to come together and almost sort of celebrate your work. So welcome to our family. So one of the things that I think is more of a broader question, we'll return to sort of Jack's story in a little bit, is how can we pay tribute to those who are lost if the information on record about them is false?
I think it's what is important is that if new information comes to light, it has to be published in some way. So in that instance, I've added to a blog. I'll give an example now where I'm working on something that will hopefully turn into a book, in the sense that I'm writing about a battalion of the Norfolk Regiment at the moment, which served in Gallipoli, and books have been written about them, and the information in those books are not correct. There are truths, but a lot of it, there's inconsistencies in what I call duff history. So I've now written a book, which is at a publisher's, waiting to see if I get the green light for that to be published, because I think if you get that information, you must get it out into the world, basically, as best you can. And as long as you do that, and I think as long as you're presenting the evidence in a correct manner, then that's the way to go about it. That's my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree, and I think that you speak about this process as almost like a moral duty, and I think that really is the case, that we are fortunate enough to be around today and to be able to tell these stories in the absence of those who can't. And I think that there is a process where, throughout this project, I found that, you know, I can't leave something behind. It will annoy me. It will annoy me if I've left something behind, because I just feel like, no, that piece of information is actually very important, and it needs to be told, which is sometimes, it makes the process a lot longer. But I think that, like you say, it is a question of a responsibility to those who gave their lives for us. So, returning to Jack's story, as part of your research, you described meeting Jack's sisters. So why was it important for you to receive this personal testimony concerning Wales' story, and how did this influence your rendition of his story in the book?
I think that whenever you meet somebody's relative, it's a physical connection. So you're actually sitting down with somebody that actually knew this person in person. So to sit with them was such an honour. And also, for me, I was able to tell them the correct information, because as we're going to we're going to talk about it, they were given the wrong information and had lived for decades under the impression that something had happened when it hadn't. And so it's just so important, I think, to have that connection with somebody. And I get it a lot, you know. Just a quick digression, I've met somebody on a battlefield tour just recently where I was doing something, telling kids about a particular action, and a guy comes up to me afterwards who'd been listening to the talk and said, "Oh, just to let you know, my grandfather was with the 10th Grimsby Chums at Loch Nagar Crater." And so, you know, I'm stood by this crater talking to this guy, and again, there it is, you know, there's that physical connection that his grandfather was there. And it's the same for the sisters, isn't it? They, you know, they knew him, they loved him. They must have been absolutely just distraught when he was lost. And so just to be able to speak to them is such an honour for me.
Yeah, speaking from personal experience throughout the project, I do really think that there's nothing more special than speaking to the family members, because there's nothing more rewarding than telling the true story and piecing together the puzzle pieces for them, because a lot of people don't have the resources to do that themselves. So to be able to gift them that information is really special. So turning to the sisters were also relayed false information regarding their brother's death, as you said. So why was this the case?
Yeah.
And was it just conjecture, or was this information sort of knowingly withheld? Do we know?
I don't think it was withheld, but what happened was is that the Royal Air Force would have informed their parents. So you imagine that certainly, you know, the initial next of kin are told something. And in Jack's case, it would have been that the aircraft has gone missing. But then, later on, the Royal Air Force again contact the family and say that Jack's aircraft was lost over the English Channel and that Jack was flying with a new crew at the time. And they actually knew as well that to do that within a kind of the way that the air, you know, well, anybody in the military have superstitions. And one of the superstitions that certainly the Royal Air Force operated to in Bomber Command was that if you were flying with a new crew, it was supposed to be unlucky. And so in their mind, because of that, because somebody had told them that kind of sort of superstition, they're under the impression that it was just unlucky that he was flying with a new crew and that's why he was lost. But of course, we know that's not the case. And so, you know, I'm able to provide them new information. And I think that the problem is that official records, hearsay, somebody coming to physically speak to the relative, whether it be, you know, like somebody like me or a friend of, will quite possibly give that individual incorrect information. They're not doing it in any sort of like a horrible way. It's just the fact that they've been told one thing and you're going to tell them what you know, but it's not always correct, as we know with this particular story.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting if we think about how stories are told and how history is told, is that it is so many different sources, and sometimes those sources are competing, and it's really difficult to know which sources to trust, because even military reports, we talk about the raid over Berlin when often it was very clouded and it was really difficult to track the aircrafts, that even the military reports which you'd think would be reliable are not always. So it's interesting sort of weighing up the reliability of sources. So how did you go about discovering the truth about Sergeant Jack Roland Wales and the fate of his crew?
So there are two records that you can go to in order to sort of clarify what actually happened. The first thing is something called Bomber Command Losses of the Second World War, which is a book, and it's published by year. So you can look at 1943, go to September, look at where the crews were, what raid they were on, and literally they're listed by squadron. And within that particular book, it just said aircraft seen to explode over Berlin. Then you have the operational record book, which I'm sure you've heard about, but that is your official day-to-day record of what the squadron is doing. There's two parts to it. There's what I would call the administration part, which is these men arrived on this day, ordered to carry out this raid. We're going to do X, Y, and Z for that. But then there is the raid themselves, and in that instance, it tells you exactly which aircraft was used, which crew was in it, and they list it from bomb aimer to rear gunner, and it does it in the kind of way that the crew are sat. And again, there would be information. If the crew returned, they would provide intelligence or information about what happened. And in this instance, it just says aircraft missing. So that information told me that, as we now know, they were on a raid over Berlin. Okay, so the aircraft was seen to explode over the city. So that is the official line that eventually comes out when other crews have been spoken to say, did anyone see what happened to that crew? And obviously somebody must have said, yeah, we were flying over the city and we saw that aircraft go up. So of course then that chucks out the whole, well, they're lost over the English Channel and a new crew, because the operational record book tells me that Jack flew with his crew. They started as a crew and sadly died as a crew, hadn't flown a number of operations together. So actually they were a very experienced crew, but sadly, as we know with that particular sort of part of the military, it was very much luck of the draw, and they were just unlucky, sadly, to be hit. And, you know, as we know, paid the ultimate price, really, for it.
Yeah, and I think that we've spoken a little bit about the myth about the inexperienced crew and how these superstitions enter into history. And so you remember that history is such a human thing as well, that when you don't have that information about your relative, going to something like superstition is totally understandable, because it's all part of trying to find out reasons for why you lost your loved one, who is, you know, obviously leaves such a big hole in your life. Yeah, and so we've spoken a little bit about the relatives, but you also had contact with one of the relatives of Pilot Officer Edward Harrell. So what role did he play in furthering your knowledge about Wales's story?
So much like Vernon Williams, he'd read my book and he wrote me a letter. And he basically said, I can give you more information about what happened to the aircraft. And it was effectively because he did some more digging. Harold is the only individual that's got a physical grave, because the rest of the crew are missing. They're on a memorial. If the bodies have been found, they couldn't be identified, so they're going to be a soldier of the Second World War, or an airman of the Second World War. But this gentleman basically said, right, the information that I now have is to say that the aircraft didn't explode over Berlin, but it made it out of the city, but sadly crashed on the outskirts. So I think what we can gather from that is probably that the aircraft was definitely hit over the city, but then the pilot is trying to get the aircraft out, as you would do. You know, you would try to save the aircraft, and obviously your crew, as best you can, making the decision as to whether you're going to bail out, try to get back home, or have to crash land. And I think it was that case, they're going to have to crash land. But sadly, the aircraft has crashed and all the crew are killed. What we then know is that they were all buried in a cemetery, Doberitz, which was where the Germans put this particular crew, which then becomes, at the end of the war, part of the area that the Russians occupy. And when they do release the bodies to the War Graves Commission, sadly, what we know is that the Russians haven't kept any records. There are no records surviving from the Germans, sadly, which is understandable because of what's gone on. So that all we can identify is Harold and not the other six crew members, which sadly is the case. So I think they're buried in Berlin New Cemetery, but they are going to be unidentified airmen, sadly. And of course, it's so difficult now. You know, maybe there will be fresh information comes out somewhere along the line, but at the moment, we just know that physically there's that information on Harold, and the rest of them, sadly, are going to remain unidentified. I have tried to look at, there's sometimes you can try to do it evidentially by looking at where an identified individual is buried. Are there any unidentified next to or near to that person? And if that's the case, sometimes you can surmise that could be the crew. Sadly, in this case, I don't think that is the case. They're possibly buried somewhere else within the cemetery. It's something that I will probably have to try and revisit, but actually I'm not that hopeful.
I think sadly that is the case, in as much as we've spoken a bit about sort of getting things proven, especially through the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and there's obviously a lot of red tape there, but it's there for a reason. I think that it would be so tragic if you told this story that you think that they're buried in a certain area and then it turns out that they're not. That in itself is another stage of the grieving process, isn't it? So I think that in a way, although it's so important to be trying to put names to graves and things, it's also understandable that there is that resistance to that process because it is actually really quite important emotionally as well as factually. So as my last question, I just wanted to ask you about, we've spoken about how a lot of the crew members are buried in unmarked graves. So in your book, you speak about the tragedy of being unburied in unknown, unmarked or unknown graves, as many crew members of the Royal Air Force Squadron were. So why is it important to give the fallen a name and a story?
I'll give you my personal experience with it, okay? I'm 11 years old, and I get taken to a memorial called Poisiers on the Somme. And it's December, it's snow on the ground, there's fog on the ground, and basically what's happened is that my dad has been given information about his granddad from a relative to say, oh yeah, you're going to France to see friends. Perhaps you could stop off at Poisiers and see where your grandfather's name is. So he gets horrendously lost in France, but eventually finds this memorial. Takes me and my brother into the memorial. We go up to a name, points to it, and he says, that's your great-grandfather. And all I see is F. Smith. And at that age, all I could think was, is that it? Yeah, and sort of like as a kid, is that it? What happened to him, Dad? I don't know, son. He was killed in the Second Battle of the Somme. But what battle was that, Dad? I don't know, son. And it really, for me, it was like, I want to know more about this. But also, at the time, okay, my granddad, who was about the same age as me, yeah, when he lost his dad, is still, you can still so badly affected by the fact that he lost his dad at the age of about 11. My great-grandfather left a wife and 7 children, one of which he never met because he was a baby. And that in himself, my uncle Leslie, he was the youngest of that family, was just so distraught all through his life. The fact that, you know, my granddad would talk about him, but couldn't tell him that much information. But there was a photograph of my great-grandfather on the wall in my nan and granddad's house. And he just looked down there and he's in uniform, you know, smiling, you know, really proud to do. Now, eventually, because that fueled my sort of imagination, I was able to take my dad, my uncle and my auntie across and show them exactly where my great-grandfather served from 1915 to 1918 when he was killed. Now, that's one family that have, even today, been affected by it, so much so, and I'll tell you about this now. On day 3 of my last battlefield tour, we took one of the students to Poisiers to show him where a relative is commemorated, and he's about 3 panels away from my great-grandfather. And I sort of told the kids about this lad's relative and said, you know, what happened to him. And then I mentioned, oh, by the way, there's my great-grand, the reason why I died is my great-grandfather's here. And I actually started crying. And because it affected me so much. So think about that, you know, that's my family story. And then think about Jack Rowland Wales and think about all the other people that lost these men and women, many of whom have no physical graves, are just names on a wall. Some people don't even know the story. You know, I help people with that sort of thing and say, you know, this, I can try to gather information, and there's lots of information you can do now. But there are so many out there that don't. So I just think it's such an important thing to do, to try to keep these stories alive. And if people can kind of, you know, even if they just listen to this podcast and that resonates with them and they understand that there are people out there like you and I that are trying to sort of tell these stories and keep their names alive and keep the memories alive, because it is such an important thing. Even after all of these years, it still I think hurts and resonates with families who've lost loved ones, even if you've never met them.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that, like you say, it is this grief. And even if you don't know the families, I mean, the people that I've researched, you know, just reading their letters, and you sort of, some of them are really quite, you know, entertaining, and they're just sort of everyday things, and then suddenly, like, you hear about them being lost, and it's just, you feel like you've lost a friend. You feel like you've lost someone that you've sort of got to know. And I can't imagine what it'd be like when you do actually know that that person was part of your family. But even so, that sort of, that grief is really something that moves you. And I think that that's something that when you, I mean, what you do is really admirable, with your Battlefield tours, sort of passing it on to the next generation. I think that's the way to tell history. I think a lot of the time in education, that sort of human aspect is lost, and that's sort of what the project's been about, is that, you know, what does it mean for, you know, a 10-year-old going into sort of secondary school to read a history textbook and just see a load of numbers about soldiers? That doesn't mean anything to them, but hearing the stories, that you've got that human connection there. And I think that it's something that, it makes it so rewarding, but it also makes it so challenging, that these stories, these voices in your head, they sort of keep you up at night, don't they? Because you're so determined to do justice to their story, to make sure that, you know, they have a name, that people know of them, and that they didn't die in vain. I mean, of course they didn't, but it's just making sure that those stories have that longevity as well. So I just want to say a massive thank you for all your research. It's really, really admirable, everything that you've done, and I'm so, so glad that we managed to arrange this interview with you today. I think that everyone's going to be really fascinated by this story, because it speaks to so many problems in the archival process as well, but also the really human aspect of history. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much as well, Holly, for letting me do it.
Ich wählte diese Geschichte, weil die Frage der Wahrheit so eine große Rolle für die Erinnerung der Staffel spielte. Wir sehen in unserer digitalen Welt so viele Fälle, in denen falsche Informationen als Tatsachen dargestellt und als einfach wahr akzeptiert werden. Aber wie wäre es, wenn diese Fehlinformation Ihre Familie oder lokale Gemeinschaft betrifft? Deswegen fand ich es wirklich spannend, mit Steve Smith über seine Suche nach der Wahrheit zu sprechen und wie er so ein Forschungsprojekt als moralische Pflicht ansieht, um die Geschichte von Sergeant Jack Roland Wales und Squadron 100 mit Mitgefühl und Respekt zu erzählen. Im zweiten Teil des Podcasts möchte ich eine weitere Geschichte erzählen. Diese Geschichte handelt vom Halifax Squadron 78, der von Donald Frank Constable geleitet wurde. Die Staffel bestand aus 8 Männern: Pilot Donald Frank Constable, Sergeant John Thomas Alfred Lovell, Sergeant Desmond Terran Cash, Navigator Sergeant Callum Mordo MacLeod, Air Bomber Sergeant Terrace Radcliffe und Heckschütze Harold Arthur Mace, Sergeant Edward Thomas William Byford und Thomas Lorne Chiola. Der Halifax-Bomber flog am 25. März 1944 um 19 Uhr aus RAF Brayton nach Berlin. Der Halifax-Bomber war das 17. Flugzeug in der RAF für die Operation. Im Lauf der Nacht waren 72 Bomber über Berlin abgeschossen. 20 von denen wurden von Nachtjägern getroffen. Außerdem sorgte ein extrem starker Wind dafür, dass die Operation nicht erfolgreich war, weil die Bomben weit entfernt vom Ziel abgeworfen wurden. Zwei Flugzeuge stürzten in der Nähe von Magdeburg ab, während zwei weitere Bomber in Holland abstürzten. Die Halifax-Bombe warf die Bombe in der Höhe von 19.000 Fuß. Das sind rund 5.790 Meter über Berlin ab. Danach wollte die Staffel zurückkehren, aber der Heimflug war keine glatte Sache. Im Brief von Funke Arthur Mace an Don Constables Mutter erfahren wir das Schicksal der Staffel. Er beschrieb in diesem Brief einen Angriff von einem Nachtjäger, der das Flugzeug beschoss, bis die Tanks in Flammen standen und der Pilot die Kontrolle über den Bomber verlor. Don befahl seine Männer, mit ihren Fallschirmen aus dem Flugzeug zu springen, bevor der Bomber abstürzte. Harold Mace und Navigator Mark McLeod konnten sich mit den Fallschirmen in Sicherheit bringen. Beide gerieten danach in Kriegsgefangenschaft. Harold Mace wurde in das Kriegsgefangenlager Stalag Luft 1 in Bad Vogelsang in der Nähe vom Darß gebracht, während Mark McLeod in das Stalag Kopernikus in Polen kam. Später berichtete McLeod, dass er das Schicksal seiner Fliegstaffel nicht kannte, weil er der erste Mann war, der aus dem Flugzeug sprang. Mace erzählte ihm, dass er die Körper von den anderen Männern sah. Er vermutete, dass er der einzige Mann war, der den Absturz überlebte. ExpertInnen vermuten, dass das Flugzeug wegen des Unwetters 50 Meilen vom Ziel abkam. Als Folge davon stürzte der Bomber im kleinen Dorf Eckhartshausen in der Nähe von Eisenach ab, eine Stadt in der Mitte Deutschlands. 6 Leichen von der Staffel wurden auf dem Friedhof in Eisenach gegraben. Am 1. November 1950 wurden sie auf dem Friedhof an der Heerstraße in Berlin umgebettet. Don Constable wurde den Distinguished Flying Cross für seinen Mut verliehen. Aber wer waren diese Männer, bevor der Zweite Weltkrieg ausbrach? Donald Frank Constable wurde am 9. Juni im Jahr 1919 in Victoria, Australien geboren. Er war der Sohn des Stiefelmachers Harry Constable und Dorothy Wedderburn Constable née Westwood. Vor seinem Eintritt in die Royal Australian Air Force arbeitete Constable als Büchhändler. Er trat in die Royal Australian Air Force am 15. August 1941 ein. Im Jahr 1942 machte er Pläne, seine Freundin Gwendolyn Stevenson zu heiraten. Sein Name steht auf dem Schild am Australian War Memorial in Canberra, der Hauptstadt Australiens. Heute schenke ich Sergeant Pilot Donald Frank Constable, Sergeant John Thomas Alfred Lovell, Sergeant Desmond Terence Cash, Navigator Sergeant Callum Murdo McLeod, Airbomber Sergeant Terence Radcliffe und Heckschützer Harold Arthur Mace, Sergeant Edwards Thomas William Byford und Thomas Lorne Chiola eine weiße Rose am Berlin 1939-1945 Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery. Ihr seid unvergessen. Thank you. unserer letzten Podcast-Folge haben wir nicht wie sonst ein weiteres Interview. Ich möchte nun ein bisschen Zeit nehmen, um über das ganze Projekt, unsere geteilte Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth unvergessen, zu reflektieren. Am Anfang wusste ich nicht genau, in welche Richtung das Projekt gehen würde. In unserer ersten Folge des Podcasts habe ich von Soldaten und ZivilistInnen gesprochen. Aber am Ende handeln alle Folgen eigentlich nur von den Geschichten Angehöriger der RAF. Die Gründe hierfür sind vielfältig. Der erste liegt darin, dass ich mich im Laufe des Projekts auf den Berlin 1939-1945 War Cemetery an der Heerstraße konzentriert habe. Hier sind ca. 80% der gefallenen Soldaten der britischen Luftstreitkräfte, die in den Angriffen auf Berlin starben. 2319 Briten sind auf dem Friedhof bestattet. 1830 von denen sind Einheiten der Royal Air Force, davon 1647 Royal Air Force Reserve. Der zweite Grund hat einfach mit der Quellenlage zu tun. Unterlagen über die Luftstreitkräfte sind sehr gut erhalten und auch relativ einfach zugänglich. Zum Beispiel hat die National Archives of Australia 200.000 Unterlagen über die Gefallenen aus dem Zweiten Weltkrieg verfügbar gemacht. Seit 2015 hat das Archiv 349.370 Unterlagen und über 65 Millionen Seiten digitalisiert. Auch war die Webseite Aircrew Remembered, Link im Anhang, sehr wichtig für das Projekt, weil auf der Webseite hunderte Dokumente über die Luftstreitkräfte aus dem Commonwealth stehen. Der letzte Grund liegt darin, dass es viele offizielle Berichte über Luftstreitkräfte aus dem Commonwealth gibt. Im Vergleich dazu sind Unterlagen über ZivilistInnen einfach sehr schwierig zu finden, weil sie so keine offiziellen Militärbehörde oder Regiment gehörten. Da stellten sich die Fragen, was macht einen Menschen aus? Was macht einen toten Menschen im Krieg aus? Was bleibt von ihm übrig? Was wissen wir über die Person, den Namen, Lebensdaten? Von vielen Toten noch nicht mal das. Darüber hinaus habe ich im Laufe des Projekts viel darüber gelernt, wie zweischneidig doch gerade das Thema der Bombardierung ist. Denn die Bomben fielen auch auf Menschen, zerstörten Wohnraum, Existenzen, Leben, Familien. Berlin war die deutsche Stadt mit den meisten Luftangriffen, dennoch blieb die Zahl der Opfer geringer als in anderen deutschen Städten, wie Hamburg. Über die Zahl der Opfer gibt es unterschiedliche Angaben. Man geht von mindestens 20.000 und höchstens 50.000 Tote durch Bombardierungen aus. Hunderttausende BerlinerInnen waren obdachlos. Auch heute stellt sich die Frage, ob und wie viel Menschen Waffen, Munition, es bedarf, um einen ungerechten Krieg beenden zu können. Diese Frage steht jedoch auf einem anderen Tablet und ist, wie so vieles, mit heftigen Diskussionen und Emotionen verbunden. Ich bin sehr dankbar, dass ich die Möglichkeit hatte, dieses Projekt zu leiten. Der Prozess war herausfordernd, aber faszinierend. In meiner ersten Woche beim Volksbund in Berlin habe ich die Senatsverwaltung besucht, um die Unterlagen über Soldaten aus dem Commonwealth anzuschauen, die in der ehemaligen britischen Besatzungszone begraben wurden. Ich fand die Unterlagen wirklich bewegend. Es gab persönliche Geschichten, Briefe an Familien, Fotos. Ich hörte die Stimmen der Soldaten, als ich ihre Briefe las. Sie wurden in meinem Kopf wieder lebendig. Ich fand Namen in lokalen Zeitungen wieder. Oder als Statistik in einem Bericht. Ich dachte, wo ist der Mensch, den ich kennengelernt habe? Es war wie ein Trauerprozess. Je mehr ich über die Gefallenen las, desto mehr verantwortlich fühlte ich mich, ihre Geschichten zu erzählen. In den nächsten Wochen fühlte ich mich, ehrlich gesagt, ein bisschen überfordert. Das Projekt wurde jetzt eine moralische Pflicht für mich. Ich kannte diese Männer in Wahrheit nicht, aber ich konnte immer noch ihre Stimmen in meinem Kopf hören. Es gab so viele Geschichten, aber nur 6 Wochen. Wie konnte ich entscheiden, welche Soldaten im Forschungsprojekt erwähnt werden und welche nicht? Deswegen habe ich entschieden, jeder Soldat eine weiße Rose zu geben. Für mich war die weiße Rose ein Symbol der Sichtbarkeit. Jede weiße Rose bedeutet, sie sind nicht vergessen. Sie sind keine reine Statistik. Sie sind ein Mensch. Die weißen Rosen haben mir geholfen, den Trauerprozess zu bewältigen. Danach gab es mit jeder Geschichte mehr Hoffnung. Hoffnung auf Sichtbarkeit, Respekt und Mitgefühl. Für andere Projekte habe ich auch im Archiv gearbeitet, aber mit diesem Projekt war es anders. Diese eselohrigen Unterlagen konnten die letzten Überreste eines ganzen Lebens sein. Im Lauf des Projekts habe ich so viel über Erinnerung gelernt. Erinnerungskultur ist sowohl politisch als auch persönlich. Ich wollte mit diesem Projekt die wissenschaftliche und menschliche Seite zusammenbringen. Die Möglichkeit, mit den Angehörigen der Gefallenen zu sprechen, war ein sehr besonderes Erlebnis, das ich nie vergessen werde. Dadurch wurden die Geschichten nahbar und gefühlvoll. Die schwarze Schrift der Schreibmaschine wurden bunte Erinnerungen, Erlebnisse und Abenteuer der Söhne, Väter und Männer. Ich hoffe, dass ich in diesem Projekt die Menschlichkeit der Gefallenen betont habe. In meiner Generation ist Erinnerung an der Kriegszeit lange her und fast vergessen. Deswegen ist es umso wichtiger, dass wir den Gefallenen wieder eine Stimme geben, weil sie in den nächsten Generationen nicht in der Lage sein werden, uns ihre eigene Geschichte zu erzählen. Ich möchte den Volksbund Deutsche Kriegsgräberversorger e.V. Landesverband Berlin für diese Möglichkeit herzlich bedanken. Wenn Sie mehr über Halifax Squadron 100, Halifax Squadron 78 oder Steve Smith erfahren möchten, sehen Sie bitte die Links im Anhang. Ich bin Holly Perchel. Und das war die letzte Folge zu unserer geteilten Geschichte, Kriegsopfer aus dem Commonwealth, unvergessen.